Welcome to the Decorations of War podcast. This is episode 64. Your hosts for this evening are Alexiv Card, CSM representative Alia Ross.
Hey, guys.
And Ninja Turtle.
Hello.
It's just this week, and we're debuting a new segment, so let's get right down to business. First of all, I want to give a shout-out to Aslet. I really hope I'm pronouncing your name all right. He's a very hard-working blockade runner slash smuggler, keeping the venal market stocked. And basically, his game is he encourages people to go kill each other out in Venal, and he makes sure that commonly used components are easily available in the market in the various stations out there with the appropriate markup, of course. Keep war profiteering, bro. I'll keep popping chips. I also want to give a quick shout out to Ezekiel Crow, who has never left Renz, and don't let any kill board reports or witnesses try to convince you to the contrary. I assure you his alibi is airtight. He was in Renz the whole time.
I'd like to give a shout out to I interviewed for a job today and ended up talking about EVE Online again, and I think I've convinced three of the different interviewers that they should try it, so if any of you all end up actually trying it and listening to my dumb podcast, shout out.
Turtle?
Oh, is it my turn? I'm sorry. Big things afoot, sieging of towers and whatnot. I want to give a shout out to CCP Gargant, who is a very nice and apparently very tall gentleman who's doing very good things for the player community. I'm told he's over 6'8". Or 6'8", excuse me, which is extremely tall. I'm 6'4", and
that's a big Viking.
I'm already intimidated, and I don't know if he had anything to do with the FanFest tickets that we got, but if you did, thank you. Making my life just a little bit easier.
Give a shout-out to our sponsor, EVE Timecode. Buy 14 EVE Timecodes, get one free. EVETimecode.com, where your business counts. Getting right into the poll results, we asked you guys last episode, has your corporate alliance put down or fought over a high-sec POCO? This was the, in my opinion, the major piece of content added with the Rubicon patch. Although the trailer is all about ghost sites, I haven't run into one yet, but I have ground out like 30 POCOs. So it's all about the high-sec POCOs. And keeping in mind, we're recording this episode the 12th of December. It's like a little bit less than a month into the Rubicon patch, and 41% of our audience has put down or fought over a high-sec POCO. I think that's a big number for 1 month in.
Yeah, I don't know if any of the of Sound Mind folks who I got listening to the podcast vote in Alliance polls, but I know they've put one down. Of course, Noir has put them down and fought over them, as we talked about last week.
Yeah, and it seems like interest in them isn't going away. We'll be talking about this a little bit down in contract wrap-up, but there's a lot of corps of varying sizes, some of them pretty small, like 15 to 20. They've got 30-man corp, 50-man, small alliances of like less than 200 people. They're really scrapping over these POCOs. It's not just the big guys like Goonswarm and RVB and all that. I mean, that might be what's going on right around Jita, as we touched on the last episode. But you got to keep in mind how huge and diverse high-sec space is. And there are a lot of corps and alliances that are trying to carve their niche out. And there's butting heads with people, and there's actual real conflict going on in high-sec for the first time since I've ever been playing, really.
It's like a high-sec renaissance.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty cool. And it's really stratifying, like, the shit high-sec players from the less shit high-sec players.
From the players who are, like, not involved and don't care and are just shopping around for the good tax rates.
Yeah, yeah. I don't see too many tax rates below 5%. I think that's sort of become the standard without anybody actually agreeing on anything.
Other than Goons and RVB, who agreed very loudly and took a number of POCOs.
Yeah.
Yeah, 5% works if you have quite a few to charge around. 5% is not as attractive if you only have a few, so yeah, it'd be interesting stuff those goons are doing with those high-sec POCOs.
Alright. Going into EVE news, The most amusing piece of news, we're heading into the holidays, and CCP has brought back the Yule Lads from last year. This is a tradition in Iceland that CCP has sort of adopted for their holiday giveaways. And it's very unique, I would say. Like, there are some really bizarre... well, it's Iceland, and it's weird. And just keep that in mind when you go to the advent calendar page to claim your holiday gifts. You're going to be able to make one claim a day, and they're going to give away new stuff. I got a snowball launcher and some snowballs today, along with some cattle. Thanks to the Yule Lad that apparently harasses sheep.
The sheep suckler?
Yeah.
Comes in to suckle the sheep, but can't, like, run away or something because he's got bad legs. I don't know, dude. Iceland.
Yeah, it's pretty weird.
He's cool, got though. Stiff knees.
Log in every day from now till the 24th, and you can claim a bunch of gifts.
Definitely check it out. Well, it's cool to see the devs dressed up as the Yule Lads. CCP Guard is in there. A few others you might recognize from some of the promotional videos that CCP's put out.
Yeah, sometimes in the past it seems like gifts may have been feeling a little bit like they were meant to placate us or, like, calm us down or whatever, but this actually feels fun and, like, ingenuitous and genuine and, like, novel. Being very
plus,
creative.
It kind of, like, it keeps you interested. Like, it's going to be a secret every day, like, what's coming out. So today with snowball launchers, I don't know what tomorrow's going to be. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Day 8, Mercurial Blueprints. Like, you just don't know.
Who knows?
And you get to look at the lovely pictures of trolls. I thought for a minute they might be CCP employees because, you know, they all dressed up for, like, the pictures on the Danger Game. But it does not appear that they are, or at least if they are, I haven't spotted CCP Guard. So.
I thought they were because I thought I saw...
Oh, Guard's in there if you're talking about the banner page.
Yeah, I'm talking about the pictures of all the Yule Lads.
Yeah, he's on the lower left.
All right, I take it back.
It's pretty awesome.
But don't try and look now, because the site's under maintenance.
I did just try and look now. I felt bad.
But he is there, I assure you.
All right, I take it entirely back.
In other news, the Dust is getting a patch. Ah, yeah. The Sinead podcast, why should we care? Well... they're finally adding killmails for planetary bombardment. So if your alliance is into territorial control in Molden Heath, or you're in faction warfare and you're into just, like, orbital striking people, hey, now at least you have something to pad the killboard with. Like, because you're not going to get any loot out of it, and who knows if your strike is going to really turn the game. But if you happen to land a railgun shell on top of somebody's head or blow up a tank with your laser, now you've got killmail for an undisclosed amount of ISK, because there's no equivalency between RM and regular ISK. So,
well, and even aside,
I mean,
from
you do buy things with ISK payouts in Dust, so you can, you know, there's some ISK. It's just that you can't convert the two between the two games.
True, and aside from even the ISK value, there's just, like, the validation that you're actually doing something and having an effect, because I know from past experience, like, you're not always really sure, you weren't really sure in the past what was going on with the orbital bombardment. It was all very kind of generic and little hazy, you know, so it's cool to actually see, like, oh, I just dropped a fucking cruiser-sized shell on that poor little fucker there.
Yeah, I think the one shortcoming of this is that there's still... it still feels like there's a lack of agency in the orbital bombarding mechanic. Like, you can't aim it or anything like that. You lock onto the planetary battle and you fire. And, I mean, you have to work with the Dust guys and hope that they're, I guess, targeting you on something. Or, you know, it sort of comes down like that. So you're going to get kill mails, but... it's not like you were picking the targets out at all. From the EVE player's perspective, it's practically luck. You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, you know, the idea is that the players in the two games are coordinating, so you're working with the people on the ground who will be able to say, yeah, we need you in the air and we need you to have this this strike ready.
Which we did. We did
sort of a more ideal situation, I think, probably beyond the technical capabilities of the games, but like 5-10 years from now, what I would love to see is like the EVE player gets an overlay of the battlefield, almost like the Dust mini-map, but it only gets populated by information from the Dust player, so they need to spot for him, basically, and they can maybe target paint something to show him where to fire, but the EVE player actually has to fire on the correct location and not say on the team that he's trying to support.
Sure.
Oh, you orbital striked our tank, man. Let's go. Oh, I'm sorry. I misclicked three times.
Yeah, exactly.
Still can't planetary bombard unless you're actually involved in the planetary conquest. But you know.
It's factional warfare that I'm thinking of for the. Oh, I guess you can do it. You can do it in either factional warfare or planetary conquest.
Except planetary conquest is really only one region, and not too many people are doing it.
Sure. Well, factional warfare has seen more usage, though. There have been dust battles that have actually influenced that, so.
That's cool. I'm really underwhelmed, while we're on the subject, really underwhelmed by the planetary conquest thing. I mean, it's been a couple months since that's been out now, and I mean, we've been hanging around Molden Heath, and it's just... I mean, occasionally you'll get people doing bombardment stuff, but you really don't see alliances moving in there for that. I mean, the only alliance that I'm aware of that moved to Molden Heath specifically to do this has all but disbanded at this point.
Hmm.
So, you know, from that perspective, I think it seems like a bit of a flop. And maybe that'll change when they expand it out. Maybe it'll change when they actually add some kind of way for the economies of the game to interact a little bit, but right now I think it's just a lot of mechanics and effort and not a lot of payout, certainly for the EVE side of things. Out in 00, it's been pretty slow. The wars we've been telling you about in the past couple podcasts are still going on, but they're pretty much simmering right now. There's been small skirmishes. A few systems have changed hands on both sides in different theaters, but no systems of real strategic significance that would be what we would consider newsworthy. So, instead of making that all we say about Warfare and EVE, we've got a really special piece. This is something we've never done before. We had a bit of battlefield correspondence from a listener of the podcast, Needon from Galenti Faction Warfare, and he has written up basically an article for us for all intents and purposes, and we are going to bring it to you here on the podcast. This is talking about developments in the Galenti Kaldari Faction Warfare struggle and the role that Test Alliance played when they joined it recently. Allie, take it away.
All right. To give you an understanding of the scene before Test came along, we'll start with some recent history. Factional warfare has jokingly been called the place where Nullsec alliances come to die, but in truth, it's rather more varied. In the summer of 2012, Noli Secunda entered factional warfare on the side of the Amar after being kicked out of Nullsec. The mechanics of factional warfare LP and zone control were different at the time, and Noli were able to reap a considerable harvest after dumping LPs and pushing zone control to 5. This was later done several times, vanities on both sides, and many veteran faction warfare pilots made a fortune. CCP augmented the mechanics and put a stop to this, but the idea of faction warfare as a source of income was realized in the minds of many pilots. Sometime later, the Galente militia had gone on an aggressive offensive, and at one point had 100% zone control, shattering Kaldari morale. At the same time, however, Evoke, who also had been kicked out of 00, entered the conflict on the side of the Kaldari. It was at this time that I, this is the author, entered factional warfare on the side of the Galente. Bolstered, the Kaldari began their mission to retake what they had lost, with good results. The campaign ground on for months, but in the end, Kaldari dominated the territory, and they were able to reap a considerable harvest of their own. This all built up to a dramatic series of events in the key systems of Ninamalia and Aha, Just as it seemed they would claim complete victory, the Caldari campaign was thwarted by Galente pilots rallying to the flag and employing relentless guerrilla tactics, holding the line in several key systems. I was there. Speeches were made. Entire fleets got the shakes collectively. It was amazing. The tide had turned, and Galente forces pushed back, sending Evoke packing. Caldari morale was sapped, and a series of coordinated attacks during the late summer months, Galentians aggressively retook large areas of the war zone. The Caldari were in ruins, and several of their most prominent FCs gave up and quit factional warfare. Of course, a lot more happened during this time, and I highly recommend Funky Bacon's series of articles on the matter on themitani.com. I, Allie, can second that. They were a fantastic series of reporting. At this point, comes time to discuss Test Alliance Please Ignore. Testies had been living and farming in the four corners of the war zone for several months. Quite content, this is a quote. Testies had been living and farming in the four corners of the war zone for several months. Quite content to, quote, please ignore and be ignored by the world of PvP folk, New Eden being, after all, full of strange capsuleers beyond count. Testies must seem of little importance, being neither renowned as great warriors nor counted among the very wise. In fact, it's been remarked by some that the testies' only real passion is for Isk, a rather unfair observation, as they have also developed a keen interest in cloaking and fitting warp core stabs. The quote is attributed to Blobbo Blappings. The above is, of course, a joke, but there is a solid grain of truth. In an interview, Test leadership stated that the move to factional warfare was in part a way to keep their members occupied, a sense of focus, a task at hand. Idle hands being, of course, the Devil's Workshop. Critics will point elsewhere for a primary motive. Many, including me, have voiced their frustrations that a great many of Test pilots seem to have come to factional warfare to farm LP, parking stabbed-out cloaky frigates in plexes and running and hiding at the first sign of danger. Did anyone say Capstable Podcast? Indeed, some sources say that this was recommended by the Test leadership. This is not entirely true, of course. Many Test pilots are quite willing to go out and look for good fights. When word spread that Test were on their way to factional warfare and the Caldari and Galente militia... When word spread that Test were on their way to factional warfare and the Caldari, Galente militia were dominating the war zone, but we knew it was coming. By sheer numbers and relentless plexing, Caldari were now able to just outplex Galente efforts and mounted an offensive to capture as many systems as possible, all accelerated by Caldari pilots looking for easy LPs. Test moved forward their deployment system to Inia, a mere three jumps away from the major Galente staging system of...
You can't say it, it's Galente.
It's Galente, and I'm not French, but it's the one with a V and a lot of L's in it. Villarir.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Villarir. Yeah.
Villarir. All right. This is going to be as bad as.
Let's just roll with that.
All right. It didn't matter that by this time the Galente had hardened veterans of several long campaigns. The Caldari fleets were simply bigger and compensated for Test's lack of factional warfare combat experience with numbers, while a lot of the plexing done by Test was done with the above mentioned cloaky stab frigates. Galente forces were pushed back towards their home systems over the next 2 months. All the while, pirates and other entities had not been dominant, seeing the potential for spoils among... All the while, pirates and other enemies, entities had not been dominant. Seeing the potential for spoils amidst the chaos, they flocked in numbers and increased their presence where the hard fighting was going on. Fleets of Balkan Express, Scum, Snigwaif, and countless others roamed space, culling the weak and unwary. Brave newbies and other neutrals also venture into the Thunderdome that is the Galente-Caldari front to try their mettle and perhaps bag a pirate or two. This is where we stand today. Galente had been pushed back, and now control only a handful of systems, with more falling every day. With Herculean effort, Galente forces are protecting home and key systems, while the rest of the war zone falls apart. Aha remains a constant thorn in the side of Test and other Caldari forces as Galente fight for it tooth and nail. Aha saw the fall of Evoke and is living up to its reputation yet again. In other parts of the war zone, Old Man Star and Hedeles have seen heavy fighting recently, with Galente forces holding the line. Old Man Gang and their associates continue relentless assaults, however, hoping to return to their old home. As the conflict draws to a climax, many wonder how the story of David and Goliath will end. Some people say, Here Testar, in the most action-rich PvP environment in New Eden, with stern competition that's ready and willing to fight, an excellent place to learn proper PvP, which some would argue they desperately need, but still many amongst their number choose to farm and run. On the other hand, if the goal is ISK and not good fights, everything seems to be going according to plan. You can make quite a lot of cash in factional warfare. It ends up being, you know, like, someone was complaining on the forums recently that they could only make 400 mil an hour farming their factional warfare missions.
Only.
Everyone who, you know, rats in Nullsec or does anything else is like, oh, poor you.
Not really. Well, thanks for the excellent piece of writing, Needham. You did not disappoint, man. It's really well put together, and I'm glad we could feature it here on the podcast. If anyone else has, like, sort of blog-ish, article-y type pieces they'd like to send into us, you know, we're happy to feature some original fan content if it's at this level. So, yeah, send it on over. Moving on to contract wrap-up. Although, I've actually got a word that something is happening right now out in 00 in 78R-PI, some solar supercaps are tackled.
Some solar supercaps are dead as a result of being tackled, because if you use supercaps without a support fleet, bad things happen to you.
Are they officially down now?
There are four of them that are officially down.
Out of how many?
12, I heard.
Woohoo!
From reasonably reliable sources. But yeah, it's pretty great job to those people who use those, who deployed those. Way to go, having no backup plan whatsoever.
GG. You know, that works out so well whenever we hear it.
Yep, hopefully the node survives the punishment of everyone and their grandmother coming in to whore on the supers.
It's not, according to what I hear from my Black Legion friends. It's like 421 people, and tie-dye is... Oh, you know what tie-dye does.
Hmm.
So.
Only 400-something people, and tie-dye's that bad?
Damn. How many drones are out?
A lot of caps. From what I'm hearing.
Yeah. That's a good point.
A lot of supers.
Fighter bombers, sentries.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of shit in space.
If there's 50 Aeons on field, you can extrapolate the rest.
Right. Well, that seems to be a pretty solid win for NCDOT, then. All those guys. It's solar supers that are being killed as we speak. I'm sure we'll get... We'll have some word of the tactical significance of the fight, if there turns out to actually be any. Or strategic significance, I should say, in the next show. But as of right now, supers are dying, and that's a good thing. Death to all supers, born and unborn.
Hear, hear.
Amen.
Contract wrap-up. We got hired for a POCO defense contract. This is something I figured would come up eventually and decided to give it a try. Based on our fight with the failed diplomacy guys that we talked about in the last podcast, someone who had their POCOs attacked by failed diplomacy in HiSec called us in because they figured, hey, we beat them in that fleet fight once, do it again. So we get down there, and this requires us to ally onto the war deck. We do so. And things are going well for, like, the first day. We've saved the POCOs. Well, I should elaborate. Failed only comes out in, like, tornadoes and stuff. The tornadoes harass our fleet a little bit. We reshipped to counter them. We managed to pick up a kill or two. Except there's a problem. The employer is not there to repair his POCO. Now, as you're aware, if you repair something in a war deck, you'll take a suspect flag. So, obviously, the repair team has to be in corp for HiSec. Otherwise, there's going to be tons of problems. Except the guy wasn't around. And none of his corp was on. There was one dude, and he was AFK. So we're like, what are we going to do? We're going to sit here and watch these four POCOs regen for like 12 hours? Oh, this sucks. eventually, we just decided to bite the bullet and try taking a suspect flag to see if we could repair them. And sure enough, failed caught on, and they would have like a neutral hurricanes and neutral Lokis follow us around to the different Pocos to try to catch our Pospreys. And we couldn't really fight back because it's HiSec. So that was really annoying, but we managed to save everything. And I sent the employer very angry mails. And after that, it was pretty much every other day was a set of Poco timers from failed diplomacy. Not quite that regular, because there were times we'd be able to interrupt them. But without being able to get damage notifications of when they were attacking things and when they weren't, and without having a complete list of the employer's Pocos, it was pretty rough figuring out when, like, stuff was coming out. Sometimes we didn't have much notice at all. But we managed to save everything. Right up until 2 days before the deck ended. Day before the deck ended, more or less, we got into a big fleet fight, finally. This is the fight we'd been waiting for. You know, round two versus these guys. And it was a pretty epic fight. It went for like 45 minutes at least. And it went on so long that they managed to reship their faction battleship fleet from what had been Navy Megathrons, which is, you know, okay, bad enough. They managed to get Navy Megathrons to freaking Balgorns. They deployed 3 Balgorns with a 4th on the way. And there was just no way we could keep them all isolated. And as soon as one or two of them got on top of our logistics chain, they basically shut them down. So we took major losses there. Without much to show for it, unfortunately, because their logistics chain was holding strong. We had brought Armageddons to the fleet, but they died, like, within the first minute or two. I think we lost 3 Armageddons. So our neuting power was practically nil at that point. And we hadn't really realized that... We knew that we lost one. We hadn't realized we all lost the other two till like, way too late. And so we overstayed and paid for it. But they were worn enough after that long engagement that they didn't actually form up to shoot the Pocos. So we managed to save all the employer's Pocos at that timer. Cut to the next timer. This is the last day of the contract. They've reinforced stuff again. We know they're going to come this time because it's the last hurrah. So we're like, all right, they've got this Balgorn fleet. They've got the Navy Megathrons. They've got this really strong logistics. What can we do to counter? So we try to go for armor hacks, and we're pushing sacrileges so we can neut out their logistic ships. They maybe do a little counter neuting on the Balgorns. Sacrileges are tough as nails. They can survive an insane amount of punishment. They have neuts, which will help for their guardians. And they're capless, practically. They only have one hardener in our fits, and they use missiles, which don't require any cap to fire. So, this sounds like a great idea. We form up, we've got like 2 ECM Tengus, got 3 Celestuses, like 10 Sacks, and 4 logistic ships. And we roll in there, then get on top of their fleet, and it's on. The brawl starts right away. But it's not working out. Again, it turns into a long, protracted engagement. We're almost cracking their logistics. Almost. But it's not quite there. They're managing to hold us. And while this is all going on, those Balgorns are marching inexorably closer to our logistics ball, and there's not much we can do. Anytime a sacrilege would scram or web them, they would get completely neutered out, and the scrams and webs would turn off, and then the sacrilege would get faction webbed by the Vindicators. So we're slowing it to a crawl, so the Balgorn just sped past. And the Logis held on as much as they could. We even had a battery guardian, which is specifically there to feed capacitor to the other logistic ships. But even that wasn't enough. And a decisive part of the fight was that a Falcon had warped in at range. And our Celestis pilots, for whatever reason, even despite being told to do so, did not range damp it out, so it was basically jamming at will and really cut into our logistics chain all that much more, which was already being taxed by the newts. And we lost like 3 sacrileges in quick succession, and that's when we knew to leave. And we got just about everybody out except for another sacrilege, and a ECM Tengu got caught as well. So not quite as bad in terms of losses as the first fight, but still a lost fleet fight, and we were all pretty, you know, pretty in despair about that. We were really thinking we could pull that third fight out, but it just wasn't happening. And this time around, they did go through the employer Pocos that were hit and killed them off. So, not a complete wipe. We managed to save them for, like, most of the week. Probably far more than we really had any right to save, considering that not one of these ops did the employer ever show up with a repair team. So, we had to use, like, all kinds of ninja repping shit to try to make this happen. It was definitely not what we signed up for. But is what it is. We did our best. Major props to Failed for having one of the best high-sec battleship fleets that I've seen in a long time, and being able to switch it up on the fly, which is really cool to see. And they're a bit smack-talky, but they know what they're doing, and major props to them. As for the employer, well, you know, I don't like to smack-talk the employers too badly, but, I mean, if you don't even show up to repair your own structures in a high-sec war deck, like, it was just the other guys wanted it more. They were putting out, like, 5 billion ISK minimum on their fleets. I would say probably closer to 8 to 10 billion ISK fleets almost every day to try to get these POCOs. And, like, it's like water wearing down a rock, man. Eventually they're going to get them. So major props to Failed Diplomacy. Good fights. Good luck. And we are happy to be done with that Poco Defense contract for various reasons. And now we're chilling out in Venal. We decided to take some time to explore the glory of the new frigate changes in Rubicon. So we're doing an all-interceptor contract. Everybody's in Inties. And we're out in Venal, in a place that's pretty easy to get to, like Teenal, Peregrine Falls, Branch, Declan. All those areas are pretty well within reach from where we're based out of. It's a live-in-your-ship operation, so no stations, no posses. It's just you and your ship and, you know, your court mates, your alliance mates, going out there and killing what you can. And it's been interesting. Obviously, killing ships with just interceptors is pretty hard. They're really fragile. Your DPS is low. You don't really have a local tank to speak of. So we've seen some interesting stuff, like with the interceptors getting their asses kicked in certain situations, but also them being able to pull out extremely unlikely victories. We had one wolf which took on 4 Inties and killed 3 of them before finally dying. But on the other hand, we had one of our Inti pilots manage to solo a Vexer, which I thought was pretty impressive.
Nice. Did he kill the drones?
I believe he did, yeah. Killed the drones, and I'm not exactly sure what method he used to kill the Vexer itself, but I think he was kiting him like just outside of scram range so he could still apply damage, but not really get tackled.
Sure.
We have a little prize going for, like, most impressive kill. And that was it until yesterday. And yesterday, by the way, the Vexer was local tanked, medium armor repair, so he broke him down through reps. The interceptor in question was a Crusader, if the audience is wondering. Now, pretty cool, but nothing compared to what we did last night, which is we found a Drake in the system in Venal running a mission. So we probe it down, send an Inti in, try to tackle him, but he warps off. Ah, all right, we're frustrated. We go to the end of that constellation, nothing there, come back, the guy's still gone. We start to leave. You know, one of our guys drops off comms, he's going to go, like, cook dinner or something like that. And then one of our pilots says, hey, you know what? I'm going to try to go back to that guy's site. You know, maybe we'll get lucky. I said, all right, I'll hang around for that. He jumps back into the system and had bookmarked the mission entrance from before. He warps right to it. And sure enough, about 5 to 10 seconds later, we hear a point call over comms. I'm like, wow, really? Awesome. So I burn back a couple jumps and we go in on this Drake. Now it's a mission Drake. So I'll figure out a brick tank. He might even have a shield repper. Who knows? But we have the one interceptor tackling him. He's in deep shields when me and another guy land. So we set up our points. Okay, now we have this guy pretty locked down. The dude that was going to go make dinner scrambles back to his keyboard and he comes out there. So now there's four of us. We try to make a go of it, see if we can kill the dude, but his tank is too strong. And as soon as one of the interceptors gets close, I mean, he doesn't have a web or a scram or anything, but he is hitting them really hard. First things first, we kill off the drones. We realize we can't break him. So we set up a stable orbit where we're all orbiting around him. And then the jabber pings come out. Help, help, Drake tackled, all this kind of stuff. And we sit and we wait. Now, this Drake is trying like hell to shake us off. I mean, he's doing the, he's trying to slingshot us. He's shooting the missiles that he's got like there's no tomorrow. He tried pulling drones in and out. I think we eventually killed them. Yeah, eventually we killed all of them. But, you know, it wasn't for lack of trying on his part. And we get some trickle log-ons. First log-on is a NAR Academy pilot in an interceptor, but not one with tons of damage. So she comes out there, also gets on the thing. Another person come out. He's in a Crow. It's like, oh, excellent. That's a light missile ship. Can engage the Drake at range. This is perfect. He starts coming out, but he's like 20 jumps. We get a third person logging on. This guy is still in a MAR, hasn't yet deployed on the contract, hasn't even built his interceptor. He's 31 jumps away. But he wants on the kill, so he just, hey, give me a quick fit. So we real quick link him a Tyrannus fit, and he fits the Tyrannus, starts on his way. Like, all right, this'll do. Now, this guy is in an alliance. The alliance lives around here, so we're expecting him to be, you know, have some kind of help, some kind of cavalry, well before our guys get here, because they're, like, freaking still in high sec. So we're keeping an eye on local. That Aslick guy was popping in and out, like, 5-6 times doing supply runs while we had this Drake tackled. Until finally, one of his alliance shows up. In a thorax. We're quite suspicious. Does he have a Sino? Is he like light railgun fit or some kind of specialized Inti killing thing? What's going on here? Now, by this time, the Drake has like gone maybe 250 kilometers off the mission warping, but you can't warp inside the missions. So we know that when the thorax lands, we're going to have some reaction time. So with all the other interceptors swirling around this Drake, I say, okay, guys, I will go and try to point the thorax, and we'll see what we can do with him. And you know, as long as we have somebody left behind to hold on to the Drake, we should be all right. So I go to the center. Ah, thorax lands. He's like 60 off me. Easy tackle. Fly in, get the point with my Crusader. Starts firing. No big deal. He's not even touching me. Yara. Alright, he hasn't popped the Sino because you can't do it inside a mission. He's not hitting me for shit. It's a thorax, so his tank can't be that great. So I go, alright guys, we got this thorax. Let's leave one person on the Drake, and we'll wax this thorax real quick. Now by this point, the guy that's was in a MAR is like practically here by now. We leave the NAR Academy pilot on the Drake because she has the fleet interceptor, which has the point range bonus. which means we're hoping she can tackle the Drake outside of his missile range. Assume, you know, you're flying around 4 kilometers a second, it's hard for those missiles to keep up with you, and eventually they run out of fuel, if you're lucky. So we go on this Rax, we swirl around it. I think one of the Tyrannuses got in close to see if he was webbed or scram-fitted. He wasn't. He had rail guns. So we just all swirled around at Zero and melted him super quick. The guy was very mad and local. I think he expected the Drake to help him out a bit more. I don't know why, but he seemed very upset. But we have some troubling news on comms. The interceptor pilot that's on the Drake is like, oh, the Drake's actually hitting me. He's actually hitting me pretty hard. I'm in armor. I gotta back off. Lost point on the Drake. At which point we're like, oh. So I really quickly, while the other guys are finishing off the thorax, I turn my camera so I can watch the Drake warp off. And God bless Rubicon. He warps off to a planetary stack, which only has three options. It's a planet, a POCO, or the belt. I warp to the planet at Zero. He's not here. Ah, crap. I warp to the belt from the planet and land just as he's picking up speed to do a second warp. And I manage to snag him. God bless you, Rubicon. And so I point the Drake again. This time, we've got the extra Tyrannus, because he finally got here from Amar. And three, maybe even four battlecruiser rats in the belt have aggressed the Drake, because he landed a little bit before I did. God bless them as well. So with their DPS, all of our DPS getting on this guy, with a little bit of micromanagement, we actually managed to kill him, finally. So we brought down a fully fit Mission Drake, which, with, as it turned out, rapid light missile launchers, and this is Thorax buddy, over the course of nearly 45 minutes, with a handful of interceptors. Top that, rest of my alliance. It's good times. Sorry for the long story, but it was so exciting and it like just happened. So it had to be done. This week in Mercs, suddenly Spaceships has released a reflective video featuring, it's like a best of some of their fights over the past year. Sort of showing where they've been and where they've gone to. It's not quite narrative in that way, but it does have some great fights on it, and one thing that I really like about it, something that more of these PvP videos need to do, is there's actually text narration on the video, so you can tell what's going on and who's jumping in and how the fight is progressing as you're watching.
Yeah, I watched it. It was pretty good. Some cool fights. They definitely seem like they have a taste for small to medium gang. You know, a lot of like 15 to 30 man, either Tech 3 or Hacks. There's some cool solo battleship stuff on there, too. Running an active tank Maelstrom.
And there were also a fleet of RR Drakes, which was cool. I didn't see that too often.
Not super effective, but cool. They also came up against battleships, which was like one of the worst things you could probably want to come up against in fucking remote rep battlecruisers.
Yeah. They didn't do too bad, though. Anyway, much love for Suddenly Spaceships. You know what I realized the other day? Suddenly Spaceships really has a lot of core corps from the old Occupational Hazard Alliance, which is a Merc Alliance that made a big splash a while back and then collapsed, like, within a couple months. But in those months when it was around, it was like the top Merc Alliance for a little bit. And then just poof, felt like it was gone. Seems a lot of those corps have found their way into Suddenly Spaceships and are doing pretty well. If your Merc Corp is doing something interesting, send your story over to us. You can email Alexiv Card or Ninja Turtle, Ali Ross. Get in touch with us any other way. We'd love to feature your alliance, your content, your stories here on the podcast.
Yeah, I'm super friendly and I don't bite really all that hard, so if you see me in game, you can always combo me.
He's really rather effeminate, actually.
I'm a lot of fun, though.
Sort of. If you're into that sort of thing. Alright, Allie, why don't you introduce us to the CSM segment?
Well, it is fairly quiet right now. We are headed into a winter vacation for CCP. As they are people go places for Christmas, all that fun stuff. Yeah. Basically it's fairly quiet, and although the stuff that is going on is mostly summer expansion type pre-planning. There's a, you know, as with the when Rubicon was being planned, there's some threads that are up in the internal forum where devs are asking for, you know, fairly high level feedback on areas of the game and features and stuff that they want to work on. Sort of the stuff that we talk about, I guess, before it comes up at the summit. It's a good thread. It's a series of good threads, but they're obviously the kinds of threads that I can't really talk about.
Kick back on vacation, work on those minutes. Yeah.
Yeah, you think you're still going to be able to save the minutes before Christmas?
I don't know. At this point, like, if Dolan just, like, emails them out on Christmas morning as, like, here, I got you this present, I'm not sure whether I'll be happy or mad. Probably mad.
That's understandable, I think.
But that's sort of the stuff. The other threads, which aren't sort of high-level feedback, are CCP bringing community and sort of announcement-type stuff, even when it's not like a dev blog or whatever, to the CSM. The fact that we didn't see some stuff beforehand caused issues with back in the fall with the TOS changes and with Somergate and whatever. And CCP has actually, you know, not done that again.
That's a long time coming.
And it's been fantastic. And I guess that should have been my shout out. You know, shout out to everyone who's posted their stuff, just so that, you know, we can look at it and be able to give you some heads up on whether or not it's going to light shit on fire. But so, that's
speaking of the expansion planning, I know you can't talk about any specifics or even what CCP is talking about with you, but you might be able to say to the viewers and the voters out there, what angles is the CSM pursuing? Are you guys more focused on advocating a PvE agenda, PvP agenda, player interaction, UI? What's your, like, number one area of focus right now, or a general theme of your feedback, if you're coordinating at that level?
I mean, CCP gave us the area of focus for the expansion, and that's the kinds of questions that have been asked of us in the feedback threads are not like, what do you think about adding mobile depots? It's more on the level of what do you think about large complex systems that are, you know, kind of abstract, and so it's the stuff where we are pushing for things, and we are pushing for things that many of us campaigned on or have spoken about publicly. But to towards a more balanced game, towards a more interesting game, but to say precisely what or in what area would
be cutting it a little too close. Yeah.
would just be giving the whole game away.
Yeah, no problem.
But I was planning on doing my next couple space hangouts on, like, just picking a couple of topics that seem interesting and have people come in and have conversations about them so that I can, I guess, use that to kind of bootstrap feedback to CCP if there's anything that we should be pushing to get in that's not covered under this rather broad and promising umbrella that we've been handed.
Do you want to plug your next couple of hangouts and their topics right now?
Sure. Let me just pull up my calendar real quick. So my next hangout will be on the 21st, and I would like to talk about. I haven't picked the topic schedule, but the next one's going to be on the 21st, and the one after that will be on the 4th of January, and I will post on my Google Plus page what I'll be talking about when I've decided what I'll be talking about. I'm interested in, you know, talking to people who do work in industry. I'm interested in if there's anything in sort of the... I know CCP has talked about POS and NullSec Sov as being two, like, incredibly complex systems that can't be addressed all at once. I want to talk to people and see if there's anything that is there that's a smaller problem that could be addressed, kind of like the SMA loot drop. You know, addressing SMA loot drops did not affect all of wormhole. It didn't, like, you know, redo all of wormhole space. It didn't change it from being a, you know, economy completely dependent on the fate of four ships. But it made it a little bit more interesting. And if there's anything like that that could be done for SOV, could be done for POS, could be done for industry, you know, could be done for even sort of the interaction between Empire and NullSec space, that's something that I want to be able to find and chat with people about.
Well, there's a lot of those little things, you know, are out there. Like, mm-hmm. One off the top of my head would be, you know, if a POCO gets reinforced, you get a notification of that it's been reinforced and when it comes out. Sure would be nice if your POS, which are worth a lot more, did the same thing.
Yeah, that's a good point. I remember thinking that when we were getting POCO reinforcement notices. I should just pass that on.
Because otherwise you have to actually log in a character after you've gotten an attack mail to see if it's been reinforced. And if so, when it's coming out, so you can go fight. That's pretty inconvenient.
Yeah. I also want to look at the... I want to talk to the team that did Siphons and just see how they're doing, basically. We talked to Team 5-0 about their metrics for... about metrics for deployable structures in general. And that was a fantastic conversation. But I want to see if I can figure out what are the questions to ask to drill down on whether Siphons are the best new thing to happen or completely and totally awful.
Well, judging by their price point, I stand a little bit vindicated on them because they're sitting at about 20 mil per, so they're a little expensive to just buy a shit ton of and run around all willy-nilly dropping them. Same with that mobile Sino disruptor too. That thing's almost
that gets shot by POSs, which I didn't realize.
It's also 60 mil a pop for those things that last like what, an hour, 2 hours, or something.
Totally worth though.
I guess.
I think. I mean, well, if you're going to be somewhere for any length of time, obviously, if you're roaming, who cares? But yeah. Metrics for those, definitely pretty important. And I think one thing you can't measure really is like the level of player hostility, and particularly on the Siphon thing. I really think the most controversial thing about them is that wastage factor. Mm-hmm. That you can drop them and even without doing any kind of follow-up interaction, really no counterplay involved, just simply putting it down will yank 10% and just completely eliminate it. So mm-hmm. It's not like... because there's really no way to stop them from going up unless you just happen to be there on grid at the time.
Sure.
So there's no counterplay for the defender in that case, which I think is just generally a bad idea for most game mechanics.
Yep, and I tend to agree. But if there's something that I can see or ask about in data that will show that, then that'll be much more powerful than any sort of, well, this kind of bites argument that I could make. Unless I've got a whole bunch of people saying this kind of bites. So I'd be interested in any stories from POS owners who've been affected by this, whose POSs have been siphoned or whose POSs haven't been siphoned and you've been sort of dealing with the paranoia. That'd be interesting to hear about.
I look forward to reading about that discussion in the Winter Summit Minutes in 2015.
Ouch. Almost got through the segment without it.
I couldn't let it go. Sorry.
I know.
Speaking of things you can't let go, probably your gambling addiction. EveBet.com, Eve-Bet.com. It's New Eden's premier betting service. Not just Eve stuff, bet on real-life sports with ISK. They've got blackjack, they've got slot machines, they've got Vegas odds for most major sporting events and esports stuff, and they're expanding the site every week. So check them out and drop some coin. Eve-Bet.com. Okay, this is, we're going to get into a masterclass segment. We've gotten a lot of feedback on the podcast asking for more of these masterclasses. And one of the most requested is armor versus shield tanking. When do you armor tank? When do you shield tank? What's the advantages or disadvantages of each one? And you're going to have a pretty wide range of views here, because I know Turtle loves himself some shield tank ships. I love the armor ships. I have no idea what Allie likes. But as a newer player, I'm sure she's going to have a pretty interesting perspective on which of them is like easier to get into for a new player in terms of skill points and in terms of learning. So this should be a pretty good discussion. I'll lead off. I'll say armor tanks. What's good about armor tanks? Armor tanks use low slot modules, which means you'll have your mid slots free to do tackling, and you can even dual prop in certain cases, which is really great for frigates and really great for cruisers, especially Tech 2 cruisers, because they have small sig and high resist. So I think that you really unlock that power by having the armor tank in there. Now you're trading that off. You're not doing quite as much damage in some cases, although, you know, there are armor tank ships which certainly put out some of the most damage in the game. I'm looking at the Megathron line. Megas, Navy Megas, Vindicators. Like, you're hard-pressed to find ships that put out more damage than that in a subcap class. And they're armor tanked, so it's not a universal thing that shield tank ships will do more damage. I like the armor ships because when I'm in fleet and I'm building a fleet, I look at ships mostly from an FC's perspective because I don't solo too much anymore. Sometimes, but it's pretty rare. Most of the time I'm FCing either a small to medium-sized group of players, anywhere from 3 to 20 people. And, you know, at that level, I need to make sure that I have enough tackle to do stuff. It's not like I have 100, 150 people, and I can afford 3 or 4 people to just be in tackle ships. Or I'm always in 0-0, so I can guarantee that one interdictor is going to like lock down an entire enemy fleet. No. I need to make sure points can get spread and we can lock people down. I need to make sure there's enough webbing and scrambling and target painting and all this other stuff. And for me, it's the armor ships which get that done. And also, they're tough as nails. Like, you can really put them through hell. And because of the low sig, because of the high resist, the high hit points, your logistic ships will probably be able to pull them out in most cases. So that's armor ships for me. Turtle, why don't you talk about some shield?
I guess I'll just start by saying it's like I like armor just as much as shield. They're just different tools. It's like you're having two different kinds of hammers, and you kind of got to decide what's best for the job, or if you like a simple tool analogy. But so I live in a wormhole, and there's some different kind of conventions that you have to think about and frame out your PvP choices within. I tend to roll a lot of shield ships because they're quicker, they have a little bit of a smaller mass, and they're just a little more versatile for what we do, which is a lot of quick in and out, quote-unquote gank style kind of attacks, you know, like guerrilla, real guerrilla warfare, real shit dog, you know. But we roll armor too, but the thing is when you roll armor that you really need logistics support, because local tanks aren't really worth a damn. And armor is kind of clunky, kind of slow. It doesn't exactly have the ability to change its presence on field as quickly as shield ships do, so you need that extra buffer of being able to absorb some damage as you try and shift around field. But, you know, it's not like we log on and there's, like, FCs that we go to. We're all, like, our own FCs. We just... if somebody finds something, we go to that person. If somebody else finds something, we go to that person. You know, if somebody's got something going on, we'll go help, and we mind ourselves, and we fly ourselves down that way. And so in that respect, it's nice to have shield ships, because it's really kind of a self-contained entity. It's, you're not always worried about, you know, being with the fleet, you know, making sure you're in Ranger reps and all that kind of bigger fleet shenanigans. So again, it's just having the right tool for the job and kind of using it. And when you're wanting to move quick and kind of stay mobile, shield is typically a better choice for you. I don't know. No. I use both all the time. I love armor ships.
I mean, there's a case to be made for some shield ships that are good at fleet fighting. Like, I immediately think of the EMP Brutix fit, which is shield. Even though the Brutix is nominally an armor ship, they have it configured for shield because it gets a little bit more range, a little bit more damage, and it's still pretty tough. Of course, the downside of a lot of shield ships, it has a huge signature radius, which makes it very vulnerable to bombs. Which, you can tune back to a couple podcasts, Freeze's epic bomber rant. Not to be missed. Ellie, yeah. Where do you stand on the shield versus armor thing? Which one do you prefer?
I go back and forth. It's, you know, armor, I like armor fleets for... I like the heavy sort of armor fleet stuff that you can do. I like the, you know, the kinds of stuff that we do with Guardians and Sacrileges and all that. And there isn't really a heavy tank shield kind of equivalent to that. Or at least it doesn't feel like there is in the game. On the other hand, skirmishing in something like a Vagabond or, you know, an MSC, some sort of light frigate ship, is a ton of fun. And I've had some of my favorite roams have been just, all right, everyone grab a shield cruiser and get in. We're going to do this. You asked about as a newbie. I just took a look through the skill requirements, and armor, to get the tank to T2, which is really sort of the thing you care about, armor requires you to train a level 2 skill to 5. That's hull upgrades 5. Once you have that, you can fit T2 plates, and you can fit T2 energized adaptive nanomembranes, which are both fantastic things that everyone should have. For shield, you have to train a level 2 skill to 4. That's shield upgrades that lets you fit your large shield extender 2s. And then you have to train tactical shield manipulation, which is a level 4 skill, up to rank 4. So I think it ends up being a little bit more training time for shield. But I remember when I was training for it, I felt like armor was worse because it took, you know, 10 days or however long for hull upgrades 5 to finish, and that felt like a really long time at the time, as opposed to tactical shield manipulation 4 ends up being like 2 or 3 days, so it's not really a big deal. I think they're both... Armor doesn't armor doesn't usually have active mods, so it's a little bit easier to learn how to use. You don't have to worry about managing your capacitor, well, at least not, you know, with regards to your tank. So you don't need to worry about managing whether or not you have enough capacitor to run your tank. You don't have to worry about managing turning your mods on and off, which it's kind of, you know, a little thing, but it's a little thing that wins and loses fights for, you know, dozens of people. But on the other hand, as an armor ship, you know, as a newbie, you will be fat and slow, and you'll have a hard time catching up to people, and you'll have a hard time, you'll get kited by, if you're in a smaller gang situation, you'll get kited by enemy fleets or enemy ships, and that can be quite frustrating. So it really ends up being kind of a trade-off. The sort of hidden cost in shield is, or in armor, is the armor compensation skills are very good. You know, EM armor compensation, thermic armor compensation, explosive armor compensation. These are all ways to, well, compensate for armor being bad. Or not for armor being bad, for your resist being bad. And by training these up to 3 or 4, preferably 4, you can get quite a lot of extra EHP. On the other hand, they don't give you a shiny new module. It's just, you know, a couple more points, and training all of them to 4 takes longer than training tactical shield manipulation to 4 does. So armor sort of wins out in the training time in the end once you factor in those.
Another thing to consider with those skills is they only work for the passive armor modules.
Yeah, so I was about to say.
Yeah.
Those passive armor tanks are actually really good, and especially when you're worried about things like newts. Passive tanks are the way to go, but yeah, you need your comp skills at least 4, if not 5, to really make that viable, and then you're pumping some money into it, pretty shiny.
Yeah, the armor, or the other sort of armor versus shield thing that's important is shield regenerates by itself, armor doesn't. So especially, you know, especially in the days before depots, if you're roaming far into Nullsec without a place where you're going to be able to dock up, you pretty much had to have a shield tank just so that your ships would regenerate their lost EHP.
This has been somewhat nerfed, but I remember when I first started playing, back around 2008-ish, that, well, yeah, 2008, 2007, somewhere in there, passive shield tanks were, like, all the rage, because there weren't actually that many players on a given fight. So if you had a ship that could passively tank 400, 500, 600 damage, like, you're pretty much king. No one could crack you, and then it was just a matter of you wearing the other guy down. Different stuff that CCP did to sort of change that, like, they changed the regen on a bunch of ships, most notably the Drake, but some other ships too. And the dynamic of the game changed quite a bit. Logistic ships got changed, so they were really useful now. And larger fights started happening more frequently, and it sort of took both passive shield tanks and remote rep battleships, which was the armor equivalent in terms of OP meta stuff, which was, you know, each armor battleship would fit a remote armor repair in the high slots, and that would be like the logistics-based fleet of the day. Nobody does that anymore, because logistics ships are way more efficient at it, and the reps that you get off an armored battleship just aren't significant enough to carry in the kind of fights that go on now.
And it really limits what you can actually engage, because you need to stay within, what, like 8-9 kilometers of each other, so, like, if you split up at all, you're not in rep range.
Mm-hmm. You can do RR shield, but it's not as effective because shield ships tend to have a weaker capacitor. And I guess we should talk about the ships themselves, because you can't look at armor and shield tanking without also looking at the ships that go with it. So armor tankers tends to be the Galenti and Amar. Shield tanker tends to be the Kaldari and the Mimitar, although there are exceptions in literally all the races. So there's definitely cross-tanking that happens. Kaldari ships tend to be longer range. Mimitar ships tend to be faster. Amar ships tend to be slower, but have good damage projection. Galente ships tend to be extremely short range, but very high damage, with sort of a balance between speed and cumbersomeness, if that's a word. The Galente have been sped up recently. If you've been playing EVE in the past year, you probably think they're almost like the Minotaur, but back in the day, they were closer to the Amar. Nowadays, if you're in a blaster boat, you can pretty much, you know, get in, start applying your damage, but that was not taken for granted back in the day. So, you know, that plays into it as well. If you're, say, a Galente pilot, you've got this armor tank ship, you can shield tank it and get, like, the most damage out of it and make it super fast to get on top of people. But you tend to have enough low slots that you can have a decent armor tank. And then in your mid slots, you can fit stuff like scramblers and webifiers, which allow you to stay on top of a dude once you get there. On the Amar side of things, you can fit tracking computers, which are the best range boosting item for any ship. So you can fit multiple tracking computers on ships that have range bonuses. And even though they're slow, you can put your damage out to like 40 kilometers at the cruiser range, over 100 kilometers at the battleship level. This is with close range guns. And you put out respectable damage, so you don't really need to move quick to do your damage. On the other hand, you got the Minotaur. They move extremely fast, and they've got the highest alpha strike weapons and artillery, and the shortest range, but I think they're best tracking in autocannon. Or there's some advantage, but they have extremely good fall off, so they're good like mid-range skirmishers. So basically, they're kiting ships. You can either kite people and wear them down with your autocannons, or you can kite at extreme range and just try to punch through their tank with artillery. Kaldari are, in those terms, I think, sort of a middle child. They're not quite fast enough to kite, but they certainly can kite a little bit better than the armor tanking ships. But they do project damage fairly well, probably better than the Amar, generally speaking. They've got very long-range missiles, range bonuses to railguns, which can allow them to hit, even at the cruiser level, well over 200 kilometers.
Kaldari also are the, if you're looking for a race to sort of actually tank with on a shield tank, Kaldari are going to be the way to go. They have the resist bonuses on some of the ships, and just a lot more mid slots and a lot more capacity than the Amar. You can fit the Amar, or not the Amar, the Minotaur. You can fit the Minotaur either way, but the Minotaur ships often don't have the mid slots to make the real beefy tank. They favor more speed.
I disagree with you there at some points, because some ships, like the Maelstrom comes to mind, and I don't know if the Claymore still has it or not. I've never flown a fucking Claymore in the last 5 years, but
Claymore's still pretty bricky.
That shield, that bonus to shield boost per cycle, and so you don't even really need that many mid slots to throw on an ancillary shield booster and an embalm, and have like a decently running shield tank that's, you know, probably as permanent, if not more permanent, than what you'd get from just, say, a regular shield booster local tank.
The ancillary shield booster really changed the dynamic. Because, I mean, aside from a few people like Garmin-type folks, the active armor repair, even though it was pretty shitty, it was seen as the more common solo PvP thing because you could still fit your tackle mods and do it. And you'd fly like a Myrmidon or something with 2 to 3 reps. The ancillary shield booster turned all that because now you can basically take this shield ship, but you only need to spare like one mid slot for the repper, whereas before you had to do the repairer and the cap booster, because there's no way that a ship can run a local tank just off its own capacitor without like dedicating many, many other slots to capacitor regeneration, because that, both shield and armor active repair units just take too much. So you had to do a shield booster and a cap booster. But now with the ancillary shield booster, it's both of those things in one. It's a huge buff to local shield tanking. So that's the in-depth look at armor versus shield tanks. It's one of those things that is very meta-dependent if you look at the fleet Yeah, which what you're going to see in, like, say, 0-0 or LoSEC when you're roaming around. I think right now, in LoSEC, armor ships are definitely in vogue. And in 0-0, it's mostly shield ships. However, I think there's going to be a meta shift more toward armor ships, unless there's some kind of significant nerf to bombing. Because bombs do damage in signature radius, armor ships have much lower signature radius, and you can maybe take like 50% more bomb damage on an armor ship versus a shield ship in a comparable class. So whereas your fleet might get completely killed in one bombing run if you were in shield, if you decided to go to an armor version, the same style composition, you might be able to survive that and warp off. We'll see. It's not just dependent on that. It's also dependent on which weapon systems are hot right now and all kinds of other stuff like super capital proliferation and people's willingness to drop caps on one another and all that kind of stuff. All that factors into, you know, what you decide to pick, whether you want something with more range and disengageability or if you're looking for a really tough armor ship that can, like, get in there and hold the field. That's very dependent on your style, whether you think you're going to win the fight, whether you know there's going to be a lot of bombers around, whether you think the enemy's going to drop caps, whether you think the fight might roll into like 3 or 4 different systems and you need to be able to move around. All this stuff comes into play when you're thinking about what you want to base your fleet on. So for the new players out there who are saying, oh, do I want to train armor? Do I want to train shield? You really can't go wrong. Both armor and shield ships have really varying uses, and some armor ships still go great in a shield fleet, and vice versa, mostly on the frigate level, but still, it's not like you'd be completely wasting those points. If you're ever in doubt, you can't go wrong with asking your alliance, or like a really FC that you fly with a lot, hey, what should I train for? And they'll probably tell you what they use most often and what you'd be best at. Or, quite simply, what they need. Sometimes you have to adapt your training goals to the people around you. Skill points are rarely wasted in EVE, so don't worry about it. If somebody asks you to train armor tanks and you really love a shield ship, don't worry about it. Your next alliance might use shield all the time. And then you might go back to using armor because a patch changes something. So don't worry about it too much. Don't stress over it. Train what you need to use right now. And go out there and experiment a little bit. Okay, guys. Last segment. Because the EVE news segment was a bit short, we're going to try introducing a new segment to the show that's completely unrelated to EVE. Turtle, would you like to introduce it?
Sure. So last episode, we had a little side banter kind of during the episode of a movie that I wanted to watch, and Alex maybe expressed a little bit of...
I talked a little shit.
Distaste for it? Yeah, he didn't really seem that interested in it, and so I said, well, you know, I'll watch it and get back to you, and we'll see what's up with it. So I did. I watched it, and I said, you know, well, I won't tell you what I said, because that's, I guess, the review. But the point of the segment is, for me, to review movies that Alex just won't watch. And it's not because they look awful, or they're terrible, terrible movies, like Fat Black Suit bad movies, you know what I mean? But, like... What was that?
Basically, it's movies. No, Nutty... it's movies Turtle thinks are good, but I think are going to be awful.
It's not even movies that I think are good because I'm pretty honest with my reviews. I don't think all movies are good, but they're movies that you don't want to watch, so you're putting the work off on me to watch them and review them for you, so you can know if they're good and maybe you were just mistaken, or if they really are bad and your gut instinct is right.
Alright, well, what do we have up first?
Well, as I said last episode, I said I had Elysiums tucked away and I wanted to watch it. And it looked like a good movie from the two posters that I saw. Matt Damon is a bit of a hunk. You know, I can watch a movie with him in it. And there seemed to be some cyborg futuristic shit going on. So it's like, you know, okay. Maybe we'll have something good there. And so the first 5 minutes of it really set up what could have been an amazing movie under the right circumstances. The plot was there. You know, you had an overpopulated, diseased Earth and really squalid living conditions for a lot of poor people and apparently rich people building space stations in space. Quite established community in space there to get away from all this crap that's going on.
Would you say it was about 1% of the community?
No, it was probably less than that. I mean, to be honest, the space station looked fairly big, but like once you kind of got like a general idea of the scale of some of the spaceships versus like the actual habitat, it didn't look like there were all going to be that many there. It was like super rich, super super rich. Like if you took the Forbes top 100 or something and put them in fucking space. So whatever, it's a weird prospect, but all right, I can work with it. It's pretty cool, you know. Matt Damon's just a regular guy. So the next 15 minutes are a little bit shaky. And, so then eventually you find out that these rich people, right, they have this thing on this space station, which apparently looks like an MRI device, if you've ever seen one, like hospitals and whatnot. Yet somehow it heals all disease and injury in seconds. And, pretty easily, as there was like a Mexican immigrant that managed to operate one. So clearly there's not a lot of like technical knowledge needed. You know, you pretty much just press a button and you're there. So you figure out that the premise is, well, we got to get there to get healed. And so the remaining hour and 15 minutes is a pretty brutal demonstration of Matt Damon's like three total facial expressions when he's acting. And some pretty terse acting in general and just really, really blunt plot devices that just didn't really force the story along. Spoiler, I guess, if anybody's planning on watching this. He gets hit by a dose of radiation and has, like, 5 days to live, so he's, like, gotta make it to that space station. And yeah. But there was some cool technology, and that's part of the reason I like watching movies like this, is because you get to see a little bit of a futuristic vision from, you know, whoever created it. So there was some cool stuff like humanoid drones, in combat and just in service. Cerebral implants was a big part of the movie, just jacking straight into your brain. And some of the spaceships were pretty cool to see in style and design and practicality. There were definitely some interesting ideas, like a Mexican hacker cartel, which, I mean, if anything in a plot just, like, smacked you over the head, it was like a Cheech and Chong-esque Mexican hacker cartel. And Charlton Copley, I don't know if you know who that guy is. He's a South African guy. He is actually probably the only reason you'd really want to watch this movie. He's a South African guy with this ridiculously thick accent, and he's playing this completely fucking insane character named Kruger. And he sounds like the dude from District 9. You know, you fucking prawn at ear. I can't even do it, you know? But he sounds like that, but just amped up 10 times, and he makes it worth watching almost by himself if you can just fast forward to the parts where he's talking, because it's something else. I don't know how to describe it. I'll find a YouTube link and add it into the show notes, but all in all, it was kind of an interesting watch, but the plot was just a little bit too bulky and frankly just a little fucking crazy to get behind, so I'm giving it 2 out of 5 shells. And Alex, I don't know if you want to watch this one. You could probably skip over it, but I'll definitely get you some Charlton Copley South African accent links.
Now, I'm curious about the Kruger character. One thing I want to ask you, since based on your review, I will not watch this movie still. Well, what is with like the crazy, I guess it's cyborg frame Matt Damon gets implanted on his character? That seemed to be a big part of the trailers. What's that?
What's so, that like,
for, basically?
He gets hit with this lethal dose of radiation or whatever, and so basically his body is just breaking down. So he gets this thing basically embedded into his body, so he's got, like, superhuman strength and can, like, move around and shit because he's in basically in the end stages of, like, radiation poisoning. So, like, he needs his exoskeleton to, like, move around and whatever. So, yeah, then he can fight the robots and all that good stuff. And I don't know, man. If it wasn't so fucking wacky all the time, it would have been a good movie.
Yeah, and I have to say that was pretty much what I got from the trailers, too. The setup was... Well, alright. The setup for me was interesting, but smacked a little... And that's all somewhat of the timing of the movie. Smacked a little too much of the Occupy Wall Street stuff. Like, you had the mass population on the diseased Earth just falling apart, and then you had, like, the super rich elite, which had the really easy life. And while in any other movie, that would probably just be a good, you know, plot setup. I don't know. Maybe it was just because it came out. I believe it came out in the election year, and that was sort of the whole thing going on. Now we had enough of that in, like, real politics. And I didn't want to see a preachy sci-fi film, so I was already a little bit gun-shy of it. And then the action scenes came on, and they were just ridiculous looking. Some of the tech was cool to look at, but I couldn't see any reason why I would want to watch the movie instead of a, like an imager album of cool pieces of technology featured in the film, and, like, go through 10 images of, like, oh, there's this droid, and here's a cool spaceship, and this is the healing thing, versus actually sitting down and checking out the characters, which, I mean, Matt Damon might not be the best actor. He's pretty good. But I really didn't get a feel for the characters too much. The plot seemed a little too convenient. The action seemed fairly ridiculous. And, like, the message was too obvious, I would say. So, having actually seen it, how did my initial thoughts play out?
Yeah, I guess that's a pretty good description of it. I don't think I went into it as expecting as serious a movie, but I definitely didn't go into it expecting as wacky a movie as it really ended up being. Like, Copley just plays such a wonky, crazy character. I wish I could do his accent, too, because it's just so good.
You'd have a South African as the next guest. You can ask him to do an impression.
But, like, just super, super thick. Almost like if you cross a South African with an Australian guy. And he's just this crazy fucking pseudo kind of commando undercover guy.
Alright, yeah. Well, that's Elysium. 2 out of 5. Now, is 1 the best or 5 the best in your shell rating?
Well, 5 would obviously be the best there.
Okay. Do you have the next movie picked out?
No, because you picked the movie, remember? It's the movies you don't want to see.
I gave you, like, a gazillion movies that I didn't want to see.
Alright, well, CC me at that list again, and I'll take a look.
Alright, we'll try to get you another one of these. If you like this segment, and you want to see more of it, let us know. If you didn't like this segment, thought it sucked, definitely let us know that, too. We don't want to bore you to death.
I was supposed to be a neutral arbiter, but there was nothing for me to arbitrate here. I'm just listening, and I'm like, yeah, that seems like a movie that I don't want to see either. So
you didn't see
it? Good job. Yeah, I didn't. I mean, I didn't. When the trailers came out, I was like, oh, it's a sci-fi movie. I like sci-fi movies. Eh, it's a kind of generic sci-fi movie. Maybe I'll watch it on Netflix or something. And now I probably won't even do that. I'll just watch more reruns of Battlestar Galactica.
Yeah, generic is a good word for it. That's pretty good. It felt really generic.
Yeah, there was that other one about, like, Will and... which had Will Smith in it, which similarly looked kind of just like, oh, it's a movie about people that do things and some action. Yeah.
Turtle, did you see After Earth?
Mm-mm.
I will not watch that.
Okay, well, that might be the next one, then.
There we go. We'll try to feature just sci-fi movies, unless we get told otherwise. That'll help narrow things down. There are plenty of movies. I love films, but there's still plenty of movies I'm not going to go watch. Anything with Medea in it? Probably up there. Anything with, oh, what's that British guy? Played Obi-Wan Kenobi in the relaunch. The Star Wars prequel.
Ewan McGregor?
Ewan McGregor. Can't stand him.
Really?
Yeah. I don't like him. He's just, yeah. He seems like such a douche. I can't get into pretty much any character I've ever seen him play. I know I'm quite in the minority with that, but it's just not happening. Alright, guys. Well, that is it for episode 64. Thank you for tuning in. Go to declarationsofwar.com, participate in the show poll, leave a comment, or put in a donation. Check out our store, welovefine.com/eve. The link's on the site as well. And you can reach Noir via our public channel, Cafe Noir. Don't forget the dot. And apply to join us or Noir Academy on the forums, www.noirmerch.com. I believe our next recording will be probably like that Christmas weekend, which may not happen for obvious scheduling reasons. So if we don't see you in the podcast until the new year, have happy holidays and happy new year, and fly dangerous in 2014.
I was gonna heal your daughter, but now I'll make sure that she is never healed. Drakey, don't trust any of these politicians. You clear out this whole building.
Thank you, boss.
I'm gonna find that little gangster, and I'm gonna take what's in his head. This place is mine now. You wanna come to my fucking house and play? Let's play.
your ass back home. Come.